Hello and welcome to Our Food with me, Mary Brophy. Coming up on today's programme, I'll be hearing about plans for a food trail to boost tourism in the county.
The reason we're engaged in this is we believe this is a sector that can provide those opportunities for new businesses and for existing businesses to expand.
We discover how a farmers' co-op has struck oil in Donegal's fields.
So for once, you know, we've got a chance to stand up as a county and as a nation to say, you know what, we've got our own oil.
And I'll be going to my first fish auction as I visit the biggest whitefish port in the northwest.
Hell, these are $3.50 at the moment. Keep going.
$3.60, $3.70.
$3.70. Keep going.
But first, a few months back, I paid a visit to the East Donegal Co-op in Rafow in Donegal. Once famed for the production of seed potatoes, these fertile, rich arable lands are now growing rapeseed for the co-op, which is cold-pressed and sold as Donegal rapeseed oil. Rapeseed's been grown here since the 1990s as a break crop, but it's only in recent years that it's been embraced as a real alternative to imported olive oils. The flavour of Donegal rapeseed, too, has been wowing local and national chefs. And that taste, apparently, is all to do with where the rapeseed is grown, as I discovered when I met Austin Dignan and Thomas McHugh.
It was only as time went on and people started to come forward to us and tell us, we'd say, about the taste of our oil, the unique taste of our oil. People were very, very complimentary about the flavours and so on. So we decided to see why it was they had distinguished us out from other producers. We're looking for what was unique to us. And one of the areas that was sticking out very clearly at us was the soil, that when you looked at the soil map of Ireland, you seen this clear patch of soil in the Finn and Foyle Basin, which is soil type number 20 and doesn't exist anywhere else in Ireland. So this, we felt, must be linked to the flavour. And quite clearly it is. We have some work going on at the moment to further establish that. But certainly it seems to be the case at the moment.
Well, the company itself was established and the first pressing was done in July 2009, trying to get people to taste an oil in the beginning. In the early days was difficult because people, while cooking with oil, don't necessarily associate dipping bread in it and tasting it. And what we found then from that was once people bought it once, they tended not to change back because you get the flavour from your food, not from the flavour of the oil that is cooked in.
Explain to me and to the listeners, like, oils work differently, different types of oils work differently when you're cooking with them in terms of how heat reacts with the oil.
Yes, with olive oil and extra virgin olive oil, while widely used for cooking in Italy and Spain and across Europe, they will be used mainly in very low temperature cooking. So you'll be cooking low and slow, whereas the Irish way of cooking is that we cook very quickly at high temperatures. So the predominant flavour that you're going to get from your food is that of burnt olive oil. Whereas with the Donegal rapeseed oil, you would be getting to temperatures of in excess of 200-220 degrees. You sear off your food at very high temperatures, you seal in all the juices, and you get the full flavour then from your food.
Well, this is where some of the hard work goes on.
At their Castle Derg plant, I get to see the simplicity of the process, with golden oil just pressed out of the ink-black seeds.
What we have here, Mary, is, as you can see, there's a hopper in the bin here. The seed is coming in from a silo outside.
So underneath this huge yellow, very attractive yellow drum, it's coming down into this press here, which is a very simple looking machine, and it's just separating out the oil from the seed, essentially, isn't it?
Yes, it's just using a process of compression, where there's no heat, there's no chemicals. It's just pure pressure that is extracting the oil from the seed.
And it's quite you can see there's a dark enough liquid. It doesn't resemble the gold liquid that you see in the finished product in the bottles.
No, what you have there is you'll have the oil, and that is then travelling into the filtering process. If you want to take a walk across, we can see that. So it's going in through here. It's going up through our filtration. it's coming back down here as the clear oil that you see at the top level glass.
Absolutely, you can almost see through it. It's that clear.
It's so clear.
And so this is the final, this drum underneath is collecting the final little bits of grains, anything that was left in the oil. It's all coming out through here.
It's all coming out here into this sediment collection tank.
Looks like coffee granules.
Yes, it is very, very fine particles at that stage. And as you've seen from the oil going into the press to coming back out of the filter, there's been nothing added, and the only thing has been taken away is the small particles. So the oil is 100% natural.
The oil then snakes along in long tubes where it's fed into individual batch tanks and hand bottled. And each batch is fully traceable to the Donegal field it came from. You're employing a lot of farmers here in Donegal to produce the raw product for your culinary oil.
We are indeed. We have a base of about 50 farmers. Again, because the crop isn't grown every year in the same fields, it's a rotational crop going 1 year and four. While there's 50 in the pool, there would be about 35 farmers will be growing each year for us. That can vary from 5 acres per farm to some people growing up to 50 acres. Mm. They're not all in the one area, so disease doesn't become a problem. We're not going in there with chemicals every second week, whereas some of the industrially grown rapeseed oils, which would be coming from across Europe, would be grown across farms where there would be thousands of acres and thousands of acres, and those would be sprayed with chemicals all the time to ensure that they stay disease free. Whereas with our Atlantic winds and the harsh conditions that we have here, that's driving the disease onwards all the time, so we don't have those problems and we don't have the necessity to go in there with chemicals.
So I'm here now with Brian McDermott, rapidly becoming known as the no-salt chef. Brian, can you tell me why rapeseed oil is becoming so popular with professional chefs like yourself?
First and foremost, it's a local product. So for once, you know, we've got a chance to stand up as a county and as a nation to say, you know what, we've got our own oil. So it can replace the so-called better oils and the olive oils and so on. But I've also discovered that it has amazing culinary value in terms of as a lovely neutral oil, because as chefs, we need an oil for nearly absolutely everything that we're going to cook. So to find one that is neutral, you know, you go into some of the more high intense flavoured oils, and I name in that, you know, the olive oils and the extra virgin. They're fruit based, so sometimes to me that doesn't match with meat in general, and in particular in this Donegal rapeseed oil one, I think you're just getting a flavour of this county, because you're getting almost like the people. There's a modesty about the oil, you know, and it means that you can enhance it and you can bring it along through your cooking and through your recipes. So I've poured out some rapeseed oil here at the moment.
Yeah, we have them here in front of us.
Just going to just take it in the teaspoon. Yeah. For me, I'm getting a lovely smoothness. And this is actually the only time I'm going to say this, but I'm nearly almost getting a buttery melt in that at this stage. And I still get what I love, which is that neutral, almost undescribable, earthy style of flavour that comes from the pure rapeseed oil.
Your palate as a professional is obviously a lot more highly tuned than mine, but definitely it's like warm butter. You know, that when butter has been left out maybe, or it's melting on the toast, it's like that warm buttery taste.
And I would agree with that, and I'm not getting any strong, bitter or unpleasant flavours.
Next to it we have an oil that everybody would be familiar with. It's the pure olive oil, and we just wanted to do this to compare. I mean, a lot of people are cooking now with olive oil all the time. So we'll try that one and see what that one tastes like.
You see, that's clinging and it's sticking and it's going to the sides of my mouth. Now, still fairly acceptable, don't get me wrong, and it's something that we would have been raving about for maybe 15 to 18 years, but it just doesn't have the flavour delivery that the pure rapeseed oil has.
I would have always thought of olive oil as being a very strong flavour, and it is, but in comparison, just having done the two together, it is so much milder and a completely different taste to it.
But I mean, number one, yes, there's the whole sort of social and economical benefits of supporting the local Irish product, but also, you know, the health benefits kick in that are twice that now of an olive oil. And more importantly, for me, I think you're adding value to your dinners, your lunches, your meals and so on in the home.
These are the kind of sounds you might hear if you were on a Donegal food trail.
Okay, welcome to Harry's. You've just come into the restaurant here on the right-hand side of the building.
Well, I call this free range at its best. We're not even feeding them, they're feeding themselves.
We have it's a two-vessel brew house. So both of our vessels actually do double duty.
There isn't actually a Donegal food trail up and running yet, but as part of its ambitious food strategy, Donegal Enterprise Board has plans to develop such a trail of Donegal's artisan producers, restaurants and growers, and target the growing and lucrative food tourism market. I met Ivan McCarron and Michael Tunney at the Enterprise Board, or local enterprise office as they're now known, to find out more about what the food strategy will mean for consumers in Donegal.
Well, in Donegal, our food strategy sets out initially an ambition for the county in relation to food, and that is to make the county famous for food and also a location that will be recognised as one that is innovative in how it deals with food businesses. Key elements, I think, in our food strategy is, one, we're trying to get more added value food producers, so things like artisan food producers, and we run a number of programmes. Then working with the existing food manufacturers in the county and trying to get them to increase their capability and skills and also their markets. And a lot of them already are exporting, particularly in the whole fishing sector and shellfish in the county. And then the big issue is probably around awareness, how we raise awareness first about what we have in the county, within the county. So a lot of what we've been doing for the first year and would see for the next couple of years is just raising awareness about the quality of produce we have, quality of added value product, quality of food service we have in the county, and then hopefully we'll take that outside of the county to other counties, regions within Ireland, and then further afield.
Food is a very kind of real and kind of tangible thing that kind of thing people can relate to and kind of say, well, you know, they have either a direct connection to farms or direct connection to the kind of coastline. So it's a very real thing for people to kind of get involved in. And we're finding that now, even as the initiative's developing and growing, that you have people coming into us going, I'm thinking about this product idea, or I'm thinking about getting into the food business. And that's where we're kind of working with them at a kind of like on a one-to-one basis or through programmes to kind of guide them through that process.
Do you feel that the county doesn't recognise what it has?
Yeah, as I said there, in relation to the likes of fishing and shellfish, we have lots of companies, probably 100 plus in the county, who are producing and selling, but they're almost exclusively selling outside of the county. And most people in the county don't know about that because they're, dare I say it, they're not sexy industries, they're not the artisan, the foodies don't write about it. Again, we're a county that traditionally would have been well known for potatoes. We have probably one of the few, if not the only, company in the country that's making most of its living from seed potatoes. So again, awareness of that within the county even wouldn't be as strong as it could be. And it's not only particular to Donegal. I think it's fairly common in Ireland that we tend not to know what's going on, who are making things, who are producing things, particularly when it comes to food and agriculture and what's happening on the land and the sea and water. I think nationally, when people are recognising the value of food and the integration of food and tourism, particularly for, if you want to raise a profile in long term, I think, as a destination, because people always look to West Cork and look at Cork and, you know, what's happening down there. But it is about, you have to build up a critical mass of restaurants of a certain level, but also a critical mass of people who are supplying locally, the restaurants and acknowledging that this is locally. And that's what people are looking for. It's that people aren't necessarily worried about where it's coming from, but so long as it's local and they can relate to it.
The food trail has to be kind of driven not necessarily by ourselves, but by the people that are involved in it, and they have to kind of own it and take ownership of it. So our role is very much as a facilitator to try and engage them and say, listen, this is what could be done, this is the potential of it. And we work with partners like Fulch Ireland on those initiatives. But then the next step then is kind of trying to create the forum for them to come together to create that kind of offering for the end user.
Mm. You'll basically put the packaging on it, but the product has to come from the producer.
Yeah. But it's even to try and facilitate that network, because what we're doing through the different events that we're doing is trying to pull these producers, all the different sectors within the food kind of sector within Donegal, together to try and get them to talk to one another and see the potential. Because sometimes we have our heads down being busy getting on with the business of what we're doing. And part of our role is trying to kind of pull them away from that at some times, just to create the space for them to think about what other things could we be doing. Mm. And it could be small initiatives, like where you have a farmer opening the farm gate and kind of talking about what he's doing, or it can be like if you have a more developed kind of food business that's kind of able to kind of tell a story about what their product is.
How important do you see food tourism as being for job creation in the county?
You know, when there's a discussion going on at other levels in relation to Donegal as to where we should be putting our resources. And people would always feel in Donegal we're underdeveloped in our tourism. And the various aspects of tourism, and food being one of them. So I think the food sector and the tourism sector sit side by side. We in the board have decided definitely food is something that we want to commit resources. We're getting other agencies to work with us on that, and we're getting the private sector to respond. Our problem is not unemployment. Our problem is not enough people creating businesses, which in turn create employment. So that has to be our focus all the time. So when we're talking to business, and the reason we're engaged in this is we believe this is a sector that can provide those opportunities for new businesses and for existing businesses to expand.
2 o'clock there for 350.
Five.
360.
Five.
370.
Now that's the sound of fish being auctioned.
390.
We're in a freezing cold warehouse on the pier in Greencastle, surrounded by iced boxes of the freshest fish, as John O'Kane, manager of the Foyle Fishermen's Co-op, and a small number of buyers buy and sell fish. In spite of industry pressures, fish is big business here. Greencastle is the largest whitefish port in the northwest and worth millions to the Inishowen economy.
Okay, 5 boxes left there. 4.
It's my first fish auction, and it seems a very well-mannered affair. There's no shouting or prices increasing wildly with every bid. But it wasn't always this way, and as John explains, that wasn't good for the fishermen.
In the past, I would have held auctions here like 15, 16 years ago, where you would be literally begging people to take fish, and you'd be arguing over as little as 10, 20, 30, 40 pence a kilo. Or, at that stage it was in a box of fish, which would be over 40 kilos, so, which is nothing. Like, you need to have some control. It's unfair for these men to be price takers all the time, so they need to have some idea of, before they go to fish, what price the fish are going to be, and I try and give them that. So that's why the likes of, with this boat that's landing tomorrow now, I will have an auction here, but it really was an auction in name only. Most of the fish I'll have pre-sold now this afternoon. And I will try and set the price at what I feel is the market price, based on what the price will be in England, what the price is in Scotland, what the price is here, and what I feel I can sell it at best, and make sure that I sell all the fish. You have to know what's coming. You have to know the amount of fish that's coming. In the old days, the fishermen wouldn't tell you because they didn't want someone else to know what they had caught. And then you had too much fish, and the market wouldn't be able to handle it.
So you're almost like stock trading, trading stock rather than, you know, the gamble of an auction room.
The stock market would be easier than what we're doing, let me tell you. I can assure you, putting a price on fish at times, or trying to maximise your price on fish, is very difficult at times, because at no time is anyone happy. If the price is too high, the processor isn't happy. If the price is too low, the fisherman isn't happy. And I'm stuck in the middle of the whole thing, so I am at all times. So at all times, I'm delivering bad news to somebody. And it can be very, very difficult.
What's going on here today, Mary, is we've had a few of our inshore fleet would have been from September through to February be landing oysters. So that's small boats. The fishing's always very good at the start of the season, and then it gradually slows down and as it's going on. So the boats now, we'd be preparing these oysters now for export to France. They'll be leaving now tomorrow, so we're just grading them and sorting them, making sure they're the right size and making sure that they're oysters and it's just not shell.
These are not farmed oysters. These are
wild oysters. Wild oysters, yeah. So these are the real McCoy. And there's really very little money to be made out of, to be perfectly honest, for the co-op. But the reason that we do it is we're providing a service for our boats. So the inshore fleet, as I say, it keeps a few lads working. That's about the height of it. It's not for the amount of money we'd be making at it. And one of our bigger boats will be landing now early tomorrow morning. And he'll be coming with quite good catches of haddock. And that would be our bread and butter, the whitefish sector. Here is in existence now for close on 30 years. So it is the Foyle Fishermen's Co-op. There used to be two co-ops in Greencastle, the Greencastle Fishermen's Co-op, and then the Foyle started out. This co-op has been very progressive over the years. We've been involved with the new whitefish renewal scheme, where there was new boats built about kind of 10 to 12 years ago. We got 5 boats out of that, which was huge at the time. That kind of made the future strong for us. They were extremely hard to pay for, these boats, but they were much safer.
Cod, five large
cod, 2 a cod there for 350.
5.
360.
5.
370.
5.
380.
5.
390. 395.
We're right in the heart of Greencastle Village here. I mean, the port is very much part of the village.
It is indeed, yeah. Greencastle has been, there was nothing else in Greencastle, only fishing. Like, you know, the whole community was based around fishing. It isn't as much anymore, you know, like, because other things obviously have taken over. Whenever the construction boom came in and so on, people moved away a bit from fishing. But, you know, like, it still is the heartbeat of coastal communities like this here. You know, like, we're looking here at one of our new boats over here that was, that man creates kind of, you know, 10, 12 jobs, like, in the local community here. Just on that boat, there's not as much fish in our local fishing grounds as there used to be. It's starting to come back again now, but our boats fish right round the coast, but they send their fish back here so that they can sustain this local community and keep these jobs here. Add on top of that then the amount of people that we employ here in the co-op, and, you know, like, suddenly you're up over 100 people, like, you know, that are employed.
In terms of the scale of it here in comparison to other fishermen's cooperatives, how big is Foyle?
Well, you know, like, the biggest co-op in the country would be Castletown Bear for both whitefish and even pelagics as well. So, and as far as whitefish goes, we would be the next biggest. And we would have a very good reputation as well because for our quality, because we work very hard on that, because if we don't have a quality product, we'll find it hard, difficult to sell it. So we work tirelessly with our fishermen. Connor here in the co-op is always talking to them about quality every week after they've landed, giving them a report back on their quality. But we also work tirelessly on the marketing side of things as well, and we would fight for every euro that we can get for our fishermen, because it's so difficult to make a living in fishing at the moment that you have to. So we're now the only whitefish co-op that's left in Donegal. We're the only whitefish co-op from here to Galway, really, and from here to County Louth and Claverhead.
This building here is Operation Central, and do all the boats come in here to this here?
That's it. The boats all come in here. They land into the landing berth here. They pick up their ice or whatever. Most of them have their own ice machines on board now, so they generally don't need the ice. Unfortunately, the BIM ice plant that you can see here now is redundant at this stage. BIM closed that, and that was very disappointing, to be honest. It's another kind of thing that's nicked away from the local area, like, you know, and it was a few jobs as well, and you don't like to see these things going. Ports like Burton Port and so on, and even Killybegs now, I believe, doesn't have ice.
And I see some guys over here, over the other edge of the pier, and they're getting ready long nets. What
That's
are they
right.
for?
Well, these guys are mending their nets here. These are the fishermen. So it's a skill, just like fishing itself, this is a skill that there's a danger of losing. If we lose any more boats or lose any more fishermen, these skills aren't handed down then the way that they would have been in the past. Now, the fishery school is actually quite busy, which is here in the village as well. But the amount of people that are coming back to it is huge, and retraining. The school has never been busier, which is a good sign of things, like, you know, that there's more and more Irish people coming back into fishing. There's a lot of hard work on it, but it's people enjoy it, like, you know, it's a tradition and it's a way of life. And that's important, like, for a local community like this here, to have something to hold on to like that. So this is our ice plant. It's not on at the minute, so there's not much activity in it. We can produce about 20 tonnes of ice here. It makes about 7 tonnes a day, and it'll hold about 20 tonnes of ice. Once you finish fishing with Foyle Fishermen's Co-op, once you no longer land fish through the co-op, you're no longer a member. And this is one of the things that has kept us going over the years, I think, is that there's a throughput of people, if you like, and once you're finished in fishing, you can no longer decide on what is best for the co-op.
And we know that the industry has been very difficult, and there's been a lot of pressure on the fishing industry. Is it difficult to maintain that quality within those industry pressures then?
Well, it can be, yes, it can be, especially when the market is bad. You know, quotas are tight, fuel costs are extremely high at the minute, fish prices are bad, but it's during those times that you really have to dig deep, like, to keep up the quality, because the price will change again and the market will improve, and if your fish is bad, then people won't want it and you won't get the money then for it either.
390, 395. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back here next week with more food stories from around the county. Until then, bye for now.
Our Food is a Hollybrook production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.